ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
It is a truth universally acknowledged that on one's 250th birthday, there should be a celebration. I'm Claire Nichols, and on The Book Show, we're raising our teacups to Jane Austen.
Why Austen? What is it about her?
Authors Colm Tobin, Karen Joy Fowler, and more will explore why, in 2025, the Austen effect is bigger than ever.
That's quite incredible.
Search for The Book Show and look for Dear Jane wherever you get your podcasts, or hear it now on the ABC Listen app.
Hi, I'm Tegan Taylor, and this is Life Matters, where your stories shape the national conversation. Australia is on the cusp of welcoming our 1 millionth refugee since World War II. What's it like coming to Australia today versus 50 years ago? And I'd love to know how you and your family ended up in Australia. That's coming up in the next 20 minutes. Also ahead, between vitamin gummies and drinks fortified with protein, amino acids, alkalineness, we're constantly being sold extras in what we eat, even as headlines warn of inconsistent dosages and questionable side effects. Why are we still drawn to food with added extras? It's all coming up here on ABC Radio National. But first, if the great Australian dream is owning your home, it should come with a caveat: owning it outright and paying off that mortgage. In the United States, there's a new proposal to address their nation's housing crisis. The Trump administration's working to introduce a 50-year mortgage term for home buyers. That involves stretching out loan repayments over half a century, which lowers each monthly repayment. It's prompted plenty of debate, but it also highlights a growing trend, which is longer mortgage terms in general. Here in Australia, some lenders have recently started offering 40-year mortgages, and a third of Aussie adults said they would take out a 40-year home loan if it reduced their monthly repayments to a more affordable level. With me is Eliza Owen, head of research at Cotality, formerly CoreLogic Australia. She's been a housing market analyst for a decade. Eliza, welcome back to Life Matters.
G'day, Tegan. Thanks for having me.
Tell me about the pros and cons of a 50-year mortgage.
Well, I think, like you said, this is about stretching out the life of a mortgage so that you're reducing monthly payments. And that means that people who may not have been eligible to service a mortgage can actually get one if those monthly payments are lower. But the main con is that it increases the cost of interest over time, because the longer you have a loan, the more you're going to be paying interest on it. So I actually gave this an Aussie twist. I took the average owner-occupied loan size in Australia, which is just under $700,000, and just did some back of the envelope calculations on a monthly payment for 30 years, which would be $3,900 a month, versus 50 years, which would be $3,400 a month. So it sounds good, you're saving roughly $500 a month. But if you look at the interest payment over the life of the loan, it would be $715,000 for a 30-year loan term and over $1.3 million for 50 years. Now, realistically, you might not be having the loan for that full 50 years. You might refinance to something shorter when your income goes up. But I mean, that's the main trade-off, right? There is a cost to these initially lower monthly payments.
Totally. But if it's the difference between you being able to buy your own house or not, can we put a number on whether you're better off than you would have been if you'd been renting over those years?
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm not providing financial advice here, right?
But
for me, like personally, I think it would be better to get onto a 40-year loan or a 50-year loan. And then when I've got higher income over the course of my career, try and refinance onto something cheaper. Better off doing that if I can own outright by retirement rather than renting in retirement. I do want to make it super clear. I think a 50-year mortgage loan would be very, very unlikely in Australia. And we can talk about the difference in mortgage terms for Australia, but essentially our banks have to carry more of their own risk. Where in the US, banks are kind of sponsored by these government-sponsored enterprises that relieve some of that risk. So it makes them more able to give out products like long-term fixed loans or 50-year mortgages. In Australia, I think that's less likely because the longer the mortgage, the more the risk that you're eating into someone's retirement and they might not be able to pay it off by the time they retire.
So the other thing, we're kind of talking theoretically, because like you say, it's not here in Australia. You can't get a 50-year mortgage in Australia, but you can get a 40-year mortgage, which isn't that much of a difference.
Yeah, so there are a handful of institutions. And back in 2019, ABC business editor Michael Yander actually penned a piece about this, talking about how there were this kind of small handful of lenders, some of them non-banks that are not regulated by the Australian Prudential Regulation Authority, or APRA, who did have those 40-year loan terms. And I think what we're seeing is, as housing affordability essentially gets to record lows, the financial system is adapting and innovating to find ways to help people into a rising market. But it's not a solution to housing affordability like Trump might tout that it is. It's a symptom of worsening housing affordability. And ultimately, we should be aiming to bring prices down so that as people live longer and work longer, they don't have to spend more and more of that time paying off a mortgage.
You're listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor. I'm chatting with Eliza Owen, who's the head of research at Cotality. And we're talking about the fact that in the States, they're looking at maybe making 50-year mortgages a thing. There are a handful of lenders in Australia who'll give you a 40-year mortgage. And Eliza, it's interesting you said that we're living longer, we're working longer. One text here says, I took out a 25-year loan at 49 years old after my divorce, $770,000. Frightening, so I make extra repayments. This person notes that some countries have 10-year and permanent rental leases and almost no one owns. It's a very Australian thing to own. But just thinking about this person, 49 years old, 25-year mortgage, what do we know about how old people are when they're applying for a mortgage these days?
Well, we know that the average first home buyer in Australia is getting older because of housing affordability constraints. So the average first home buyer age in Australia was last reported by the ABS at 35 years. Mm. So if you're taking on a 30-year loan, then you're looking at being very close to retirement age by the time you pay it off. As this person on the text line notes, a lot of Australians are actually pretty good at getting ahead of their mortgage payments quickly. Very few Australians borrow up to their maximum capacity, and nominal incomes will rise over time. So that will, you know, as inflation goes up over time, that erodes the real value of debt. And it does make it a bit easier to get ahead of mortgage repayments, build up your buffers, and hopefully not have to service the full term. I also think it's really interesting, the 25-year loan term, that was kind of the common thing when I started my career 10 years ago. Mm. Now it's definitely 30 years. So it's interesting to see how, even though Australia might not get a 50-year mortgage, the loan term has definitely expanded and the 30-year has become the new norm over time.
And we're borrowing later, so it's pushing those repayments into our later, an older bracket than we would have previously been paying.
And we're borrowing more. If you look at research too, the Household Income and Labour Dynamic Survey in Australia has found that in the past 20 years, there has been an increase of people who have mortgage debt when they retire, from 13% back in 2003 to 17% in 2023. And of course, the other consequence of all this is that people just don't get mortgages at all, and we have more people in the private rental market over their lifetime.
On the text line, a couple of people pointing out another notable difference between Australia and the US, which is that they have a 50-year fixed interest rates too, not variable rates. Stefan in Tasmania is saying that. Another person says, if we're going to import anything from America, it would be fixed-term interest rates that last up to 30 years. What do you say to that, Eliza?
Yeah, so the vast majority of new lending in Australia is on variable terms. At the end of 2024, only 3% of outstanding mortgage debt was on fixed terms. So for those who aren't aware, fixed versus variable, fixed is basically you get the same rate over the life of the loan. Variable mortgage rate follows changes in funding costs for banks and are very closely influenced by the cash rate. So if the cash rate goes down, variable mortgage rate holders do benefit from lower mortgage rates if the banks pass them on. Now, Australia did actually do some research on this. The government produced a research paper in 2022-23, and the findings were basically that in the US, the risk associated with issuing 30-year fixed-rate mortgages is shared between lenders, government-sponsored enterprises, so think Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. We don't have the same system in Australia. Banks have to take on more of their own risk. That's the way our financial system is set up. And for those banks, it's more risky for them to fix your rate over the life of the loan. And that's why variable tends to be the norm here.
Here on Life Matters on ABC Radio National, we're chatting about mortgages. Just a nice Tuesday morning pick-me-up to make you feel a bit depressed about the cost of living and whatnot, whether we should be looking at longer-term mortgages here in Australia, following in the footsteps of the US, where they're talking about 50-year mortgages. One person says, let's face it, having a 50-year mortgage is not owning a home, it's renting a home from the bank. Another says, at that point, you're better renting and investing money elsewhere. Well, also with me is Molly Benjamin, who's the founder of Ladies Finance Club, which is a platform that helps women take control of their financial future. Molly, just to be clear, are we giving advice only to ladies today, or can anyone take part?
Look, anyone can take part. It's not just the ladies.
Good to know. What are some of the challenges you're hearing from your members when they're talking about buying their first homes?
Look, I actually went out to a bunch of members to get like the real life, like what's your biggest concern? And not surprisingly, it's the same things that come up, which is not enough of a deposit or not being able to save fast enough, then the market is going up. And also the challenge of saving a deposit while paying big rents. And especially a lot of women in our community were saying, you know, they've got these high paying roles, which mean they need to be in big cities, but then they still can't even afford to buy even an hour out of the city. It's just not within reach. So the affordability piece is a big one. And then also, you know, stamp duty still being a major hurdle, even with concessions, many buyers in the suburbs where they live and work still fall above the waiver thresholds. But then also not knowing where to buy. And something I do hear quite a lot is a bit of like fear and a bit scared because, you know, this is like, you know, more than, you know, for some people, it's over $500,000. It's a $1 million decision. It's not like buying a pair of shoes. You can't just take it back if you get it wrong. So there's a number of different concerns we're seeing.
Do you think your members would consider that longer term home loan if it meant the lower monthly repayments?
Well, I like to think of my ladies as quite switched on, educated and savvy. So I think when they do the math, that would not be a path they would want to go down just because of how much extra they'll be paying. There's other schemes out there, the 5% or, you know, using lenders' mortgage insurance. I think they would look for other avenues before taking on such a big loan.
Really strong theme coming through on the text line. I read out that text before about someone in their late 50s needing to buy after a divorce. Another text, I took out a new mortgage at 51 after divorce. I'm due to pay off aged 77 or I'll downsize and repay. And Wendy says, I obtained a $300,000 30-year loan at 57 after a divorce. The only way I'll pay it off is to sell. Molly, is this a theme you hear with your members?
Absolutely. We're seeing a lot of women coming out of divorces and separations and in this position now where they might be using money from the settlement to get in the property ladder, hoping that either that property will go up in value or then they will downsize later on. But it's definitely something we're seeing so often at Ladies Finance Club for sure.
Eliza, do we have the settings right? If this is something that's happening in Australia, are we able to kind of support that group?
Oh, I think there's a lot of challenges with it. I mean, you hear that statistic of the fastest growing cohort of homelessness in Australia is women over 50. And I think divorce is something that is a vulnerability that we've only really, at least from the observation in my career, is something that we've really only been talking about for maybe the past 5 years or so. We want a housing system that basically promotes autonomy, right? If you want to live alone, you should be able to afford to live alone. If you want to live in share housing or, you know, with a partner, that's great.
but we need to make sure that housing is affordable and accessible, whether you're a renter, single, and that's about, you know, continuing to build, continuing to increase housing supply, but also making sure that there's a steady stream of non-market stock, so boosting social and affordable housing. And I think also tackling some of the factors that increase demand for housing, like tax breaks for investors, for example, that would help take pressures off prices and would mean that people don't have to rely as much on longer loan terms or getting into large debt later in life in order to afford their own home.
It's Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor. I'm with Eliza Owen from Cotality and Molly Benjamin, who's the founder of the Ladies Finance Club, talking about the push for longer mortgages, at least in the United States. You can get a 40-year mortgage in Australia if you're prepared to not go to one of the big banks. One says this mortgage madness needs to stop. After the gains of the Industrial Revolution, computer automation and the information revolution, how can it be the case that we need to work harder and longer just to rest at night in a home you won't get kicked out of? Another says this is another demand-side manipulation. Supply is the issue. We need to address infrastructure and help our growing population understand and embrace density, which itself needs to be properly planned. So picking up on some of Eliza's threads there, Molly, I'd love to come to you about your personal story, because you are thinking a lot about money and how you distribute it, and you've decided not to buy the home that you live in.
Yeah, so I have chosen to rent vest. I live in beautiful Bondi, but the average home is not in my budget. So I worked with some different buyer's agents and found a property in Toowoomba in Queensland. And then I was able to buy another property in Launceston. Now, again, I'm not necessarily pro-property investing, but also it's the game we've been given. And so as I say, don't hate the play, hate the game. And so unless, you know, the game changes, why shouldn't I benefit from the system that's been created?
Yeah, I was going to say, Molly, sorry for the tax breaks for investors comment, but it's so true. Like, we've got ourselves into a system where housing has become so out of reach that rent vesting has increased as a strategy where people buy what they can afford and rent where they want to live, right? But it's still seen as a way to kind of grow wealth. When you say it out loud, it feels a bit absurd. It's like you can't afford a property, so you've got to buy a property before you can buy a property.
I know. And then getting people in that area where I've bought out of the market, because then I'm buying in places I can afford, they're not going to be able to afford there. So it seems like the big issue is like that supply issue and also the tax system.
So, Eliza, while we're waiting for the tax system to catch up with what it sounds like would be good for us as a society, how do we, play the cards we've been dealt, play the game that's currently in play? What sort of things do people need to keep in mind?
Well, I think, what Molly's doing is really great, because it's all about financial education for everyone. But, you know, it's great to see that also targeted at women who statistically tend to have lower levels of financial literacy. I think just being aware about terms, even something as fundamental as understanding how interest works, that's going to help you navigate things like loan terms, fixed and variable, in order to kind of optimize your mortgage costs or your investment strategy and do what is best for you. Unfortunately, I think systematically we are just entering this period where home ownership has been on the steady decline over the past 20 years. Another financial strategy in a way is to educate yourself about the tax and policy changes that can affect a better housing market and use your vote as well as your money.
Eliza and Molly, thank you both so much for joining me today. Eliza Owen is head of research at Cotality, which was formerly CoreLogic Australia. Molly Benjamin's the founder of the Ladies Finance Club. I will just reiterate, this is general advice only. Please don't base your financial decisions on something you heard on the radio, but maybe use it as a chance to figure out how to educate yourself better. I've also really enjoyed reading your texts this morning. One says, I'm a man at 53 who's just left a decade-long relationship. The cash settlement I have wasn't enough to put me back into the property market after after selling the family home. I'm now having to invest it in a business to hopefully grow and leave me enough money to buy my own home before retirement. Unless I work until that time, the future doesn't look exactly bright. Another, as a single mother and nurse, I finally got a deposit for an apartment in my late 50s. Could only get a 30-year loan, but much rather be paying my place off than trying to find a rental. And on the idea of longer mortgage terms, one person says, this is the wrong move. More money for the banks. Need to more split homes built and programs for joint renters to combine and buy. Well, stick with me here on Life Matters on ABC Radio National, because coming up next, we are, as a nation, about to welcome our 1 millionth refugee since World War II. We're going to talk about what that looks like in Australia, and I'd also love to know how you and your family ended up in Australia.
It is a truth universally acknowledged that on one's 250th birthday, there should be a celebration. I'm Claire Nichols, and on The Book Show, we're raising our teacups to Jane Austen.
Why Austen? What is it about her?
Authors Colm Tobin, Karen Joy Fowler, and more will explore why, in 2025, the Austen effect is bigger than ever.
It's quite incredible.
Dear Jane, on The Book Show Mondays at 10 on ABC Radio National, or anytime on the ABC Listen app.
Australia is on the cusp of welcoming its 1 millionth refugee since the Second World War. Behind that statistic are so many stories of upheaval and hardship, but also resilience and hope in starting a new life. So how should we reflect on this moment? Well, you're about to hear from a refugee advocate about his own story and the work he does now, and a legal researcher to paint a picture of Australia's refugee intake over the decades. With me is Oggie Seamich, the head of the Refugee Leadership and Advocacy at Asylum Seeker Resource Centre. Oggie, welcome to Life Matters.
Good morning. Thanks so much.
You arrived in Australia when you were 11. What do you remember about that day?
Well, firstly, it's such a privilege to be able to reflect on what it means to be one in a million refugees welcomed since World War II. Unfortunately, my childhood was shattered by civil war that erupted in the hometown of Sarajevo, which was a place that only a few years before that was on global centre stage as it held the Winter Olympics. Our journey was quite difficult, but eventually did lead us to Australia. It was the 8th of August, 1998. Just like your birth date, it's a date you never forget. I was 11 years old, and I remember stepping off the plane. We didn't speak any English. We didn't know anything about Australia. We didn't know anyone. As a kid, I still thought that I'd see kangaroos every day on my way to school. We're exhausted, frightened, but we were also relieved, maybe excited. My mum valued education above anything else, so we all went to school. My brother's to high school, I went to primary school, my mother went to English classes, then went on to do a bridging course in university to study, be a social worker. So many people had helped us that she wanted to give back. At night, we would sit at home and read the dictionary together, testing each other on what different words meant. We worked so hard to start a new life.
Oh my gosh, the picture of you sitting around reading the dictionary has bringing a little tear to my eye, Oggie. What kind of support did your family have at that time?
Because we came to Australia through the humanitarian program, the support we received meant that we had work rights, we had Medicare, that we had social security support, had access to English classes, and that we knew that there was a pathway for us to get permanency. That gave us a huge amount of security and what we needed in order to be able to start to rebuild our lives, which was really quite incredible.
Did that experience of, I mean, I'm sure it did. How did that experience of yours inform your decision to move to work at the Asylum Seeker Resource Centre?
Well, I just think every single day that we were so incredibly lucky. Through all the times when we didn't have any money, through all the hardship, the incredible stress that my mother must have felt. I remember night after night with no electricity living in Serbia before we were able to get into Germany. We were lucky that we got out of Sarajevo when many people didn't, that we arrived and survived in Serbia, that we somehow managed our way into Germany, that we were able to come to Australia. We were lucky to be four in a million. So many of the people that I work with now live lives compounded with so many different difficulties, no access to work rights, no Medicare, where children can't go to university. And it drives me every day to go to work and try and change government policies away from cruelty towards fairness and compassion. And just like my mother did when we arrived in Australia and she went on to study to be a social worker, I feel a strong sense of wanting to give back. And so many of the refugees that I work with are exactly the same.
You're listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor. The voice you're hearing is that of Oggy Simic, who's the head of refugee leadership and advocacy at the Asylum Seeker Resource Centre. Himself came to Australia at 11 as a refugee and just telling a really touching story about how he and his family found a home here. The reason we're talking about this today is because Australia is about to welcome, at some stage before the end of the year, its 1 millionth refugee since World War II. One person says, came from holiday, meet the mother-in-law first. She introduced us, love at first sight, got married and stayed forever, and I love it here. Well, also with me is Daniel Gazulbash, who's a professor and director of the Caldor Centre for International Refugee Law at the University of New South Wales. Daniel, we've had 1 million refugees, give or take, since World War II. Can you talk me through where these people have come from over the decades?
Thanks so much for having me on the show, Tegan. Maybe before we jump into explaining Australia's experience of welcoming refugees, it's worth situating our post-war actions in the context of the development of the global refugee regime. Mm-hmm. And the 1951 Convention really came out of the rubble of World War II. It defined who should be considered a refugee and established the rights and protections owed to them. And it was really a response to the failure of states to offer protection in the lead up and during the war. And we had, you know, really tragic and infamous incidents like the SS St. Louis, which was an ocean liner carrying 800 Jewish refugees that was arrived in the US, was pushed back, and passengers ended up back in Europe, and many of them lost their lives tragically in concentration camps. And so the government support for the Refugee Convention was really a way of saying never again. Mm. And this included Australia, and you know, we should be proud that it was the country's signature that brought the convention into force. And you know, in the early post-war years, from 1947 to 1953 alone, we welcomed over 170,000 displaced people to Australia from the camps of Europe. And we stepped up and we did it again in the aftermath of the Vietnam War, where we welcomed 150,000 refugees from the region over a number of years. And you know, over the last few decades, our intake has been quite diverse. We've had, you know, large numbers of refugees welcomed from Afghanistan, Iraq, Myanmar, Syria and Sudan, which make up the top five countries of origin.
So there's sort of two groups of people here that we're talking about. Refugees, we have a pretty generous program in the world, if I'm not mistaken, but then we also have very restrictive policies when it comes to asylum seekers. Can you unpick that a bit for me?
Yeah, so the vast majority of this 1 million number that we're celebrating today came in through what's known as our resettlement program. So these are programs through which the government basically selects and brings in refugees and people in humanitarian need to Australia. And this is a distinction to our asylum program. And so that applies to people who arrive in Australia, whether with or without a visa, and are then granted asylum on the basis that they would face persecution or other forms of harm if they were sent home. And, you know, since 2013, it's been almost impossible to reach, has been impossible to reach Australia by boat without authorization and apply for asylum. So those that try have been either pushed back at sea or transferred to our offshore processing centres on Nauru and formerly Manus Island in Papua New Guinea. And so that means our current asylum program is only open to those that can obtain a visa, such as a tourist visa or a student visa, and fly to Australia. And really, I think there's this contrast tension in our current approach, where we do have a very generous resettlement program by international standards, but at the same time, some of the harshest asylum policies, not only in terms of denying access to Australia, but also the way we treat asylum seekers after they arrive here.
Yeah, Oggy, in light of that, how do you think we should be reflecting on this milestone of our millionth refugee?
Well, I think it's really important, and thank you to Daniel for outlining what is quite complicated. And I just wanted to add that, you know, regardless of how you came to Australia, you are a refugee. And it's hard to believe that the government treats people differently depending on when they arrived, how they arrived, and where they've come from. As we welcome the 1 millionth refugee, I think that we have to think about our government policies and recognise that actually our government policies at the moment are out of step with our community in so many ways that there is an opportunity for us to shift towards more compassionate policies that embrace difference and embrace humanity, our common humanity.
Here on Life Matters on ABC Radio National, I'm Tegan Taylor talking with Oggy Simic, who's with the Asylum Seeker Resource Centre, and Daniel Gazabash, who's a professor and the director of the Caldor Centre for International Refugee Law at UNSW, reflecting on the fact that sometime between now and the end of the year, Australia will welcome its 1 millionth refugee since World War II. It's a milestone, but it's not an uncomplicated one to reflect on because of the tension between our generous refugee program, as we've heard, and our asylum seeker policies. I'd love to know how your family came to be in Australia. If you want to share the story, I'd really love to hear it. My text number is 0418 226 576. One says, I was 8 when I came to Australia. I was an A student in my country, but dropped to C because of English. I'd take ages to learn because I heard English, translated to my language, then translated to English to speak. Sometimes I'd hear English and respond in my language. It was such a trip. Now I see and hear and speak only English, and my mother tongue is second. You lose some of yourself to live in a new country. Switching between two languages also means hearing your inner voice in two languages. With language is also culture. Some things are odd or negative in English that are acceptable in my language, so you can choose how you relate to others in both ways. We were not refugees, but part of a family reunion program. Oggy, what I really hear there is just how rich our multicultural community is, and I wonder if that's something that we celebrate enough.
Yeah, it's quite incredible. And, you know, I reflect on that in my own life so much that because I had the opportunity to live in Serbia, in Germany, and then come to Australia, learn three languages before I was 11 years old, I look back at that and feel quite lucky at the opportunity that I had to learn about different cultures and have all those different experiences in different places. And ultimately, when people arrive in Australia and they bring these different cultures with them, they make the place such a more vibrant and a much nicer place to be. Just last week, I was walking through the streets of Dandenong and reflecting on the incredible businesses that were built there by people who arrived by boat and now employ hundreds of people that have started a new life and have contributed so much. I think about all the people who are community leaders now, doctors, educators, community workers, people that make our community a better place to live, people who we turn to, our neighbours, people who we work with, people who we celebrate.
Oggy, you've got two kids now. I'm trying to think about what it must feel like to look at them living this life in Australia and contrast it with your own early childhood.
Yeah, it's quite incredible. And I often talk to them about it. It provides an excellent opportunity for us to have really rich and quite incredible conversations. My life was so different to theirs. I jumped from school to school and constantly had to meet new people and make new friends. Whereas my son, for example, he's been in the same friendship group since he was in third year of kinder, and he's now in his second year of school. So it is quite incredible, but in them is also such a big part of us and an opportunity for us to talk about the experiences we've had enriches their lives as well, and hopefully means that they go on and continue to be people that accept and welcome and treat others with the same sort of humanity that their father was once treated with.
Mm. Daniel, just reflecting on what we're kind of celebrating today, which is our multicultural nation and the all of the good things that refugees have brought to Australia, do we have the settings right? Do we need to rethink what maybe the next million looks like?
Look, I think this moment is really an opportunity both to sort of celebrate the sort of transformative contributions that refugees and their families have made to both our economy but also our social fabric over 7 decades, to really take pride in that history of moral national action, but also to reassess our current practices, particularly in relation to asylum, and to revive our the politics of our better instincts. We have done much more in terms of the both at times the raw numbers, but particularly per capita on the number of people we take overall in Australia. We can do it again. And what we really need on this issue is political leadership that speaks to values like compassion and justice that we know that all Australians hold dear. But unfortunately, we're just not seeing that political leadership from the major parties today.
So, Ogi, we're hearing Daniel saying we used to take more per capita. We had more raw numbers of refugees coming to Australia. But at the moment, there are mass immigration rallies. There's a lot of fear and misunderstanding in the community. What kind of attitude would you like to see from the top in Australia?
Well, I think that what some of those rallies speak to and some of the policies that we've talked about, which now punish people instead of treat them with compassion, it says that our government and government policies are out of step with our community, and that we've allowed a minority of neo-Nazis and right-wing actors to be able to dominate media headlines. I think that our story has to shift away from that, and that it will only shift towards a place that's more difficult and less accepting of people if we allow it to. Like Daniel was just saying, the majority of Australians I know see themselves as fair and compassionate and recognise that we're a country of migrants, that we're built on multiculturalism, and that our community thrives when we remember our shared humanity.
So as a dad, Ogi, looking to the future, what kind of Australia would you like to see them continue to grow up in?
Well, I think looking at what's happening around the world, where we're seeing terrible atrocities, conflicts, genocides playing out on our mobile phones in our lifetime, at a time when the climate crisis threatens our Pacific neighbours, and we will see more people across the globe forcibly displaced. I'm always reminded of what Con, the founder and CEO of at ASRC, says, which is that now is the time for us to build longer tables and not bigger walls. We want compassion, not cruelty, to shape Australia's future. And like I've been saying, for us to remember our shared humanity, that at any given moment in time, it could be us that's forced to flee our home.
Ogi, Daniel, thank you both so much for sharing today. Ogi Simic is the Head of Refugee Leadership and Advocacy at the Asylum Seeker Resource Centre. And Daniel Gezelbash is a Professor and Director of the Caldor Centre for International Refugee Law at the University of New South Wales. And thank you for sharing your Aussie origin stories with me today. Annika says, "We escaped on foot in the dark of night from Hungary in 1956. I was 18 months old in a backpack on my dad's back. My parents embraced Australia as their new home and loved it." Well, coming up next here on Life Matters, how did a trend of adding proteins and vitamins to everything even start? Why do we keep buying things that have extra stuff in them? That's next.
Gallipoli, Vietnam.
The difficult stories of war have always been told through the arts.
Because while journalists tell us what happened, it's our performers, filmmakers, writers, artists, and musicians who help us make sense of it.
Rachel Griffiths presents When the War is Over.
If it's too risky to say, sing it.
Starts tonight on ABC TV or stream all the episodes on ABC iView.
So I was in the shops the other day and I saw a label that made me do a double take: protein, water. We've spoken before about protein being added to everything: protein coffee, protein lollies, protein ice cream. But it's not just protein anymore. There's a trend of adding supplements and vitamins to every meal, every snack. There's vitamin gummies, there's drinks fortified with this and that. We're constantly being sold extras, even as we're also getting messages about inconsistent dosages, questionable effectiveness. So why are we still drawn to them? In today's episode of Buyer Beware with consumer expert Paul Harrison, Paul, have you ever fallen under the spell of one of these enhanced foods?
I do all the time, Tegan. I am just as human as everybody else. And I think the reason is because these products work in that space between science and feelings. And I think marketing is really clever at working in that world of feelings. So, you know, protein water is one example. Antioxidants is another one. Again, most people wouldn't even know what an antioxidant is. Added vitamin C, it can all kind of shift how we feel about that product. And there's lots of research showing that depending on the emotional state that we're in, we actually do respond to it. So people, if somebody's tired and anxious about their health, they're more likely to take these claims at face value. But other people might just see it as a kind of a small reassurance, this idea of, yeah, I want to eat these lollies. I want to do this thing. And it becomes something that marketers can use to put pricing up as well, like protein water, whatever that is. I mean, you could start putting things like added protein to meat and people wouldn't really question it, because I think what's driving this is this self-discrepancy, this idea that there's this quiet gap between who we are, who we want to be, and who we think we ought to be. And that's really where marketing plays a part. It's this idea of how you bridge that gap between the current self and this ideal or this person I should be self.
I love this idea of self-discrepancy because it really puts some marketing language around the version of future me who rules and my current like lizard-like self. So can you tell me a bit more about this concept?
Well, I guess what it tells us is that we have an idea of who we are. So, and that's based on what people tell us, how we see ourselves, what the media and things like that tell us. But part of, you know, I guess that evolutionary process is that we want to progress. We want to kind of move forward. And there's two kind of discrepancies that we live with. One of them is this person that I aspire to be, you know, like I might want to be a leader or I want to be big and strong or something like that. But I think one of the other ones that we don't think about is this person that we think we ought to be. So things like I need to be a good mother or a good parent. All of these things feed into what we call this self-discrepancy, and it creates this gap. And what we try to do and what marketing does is it helps to, I guess, bridge that gap between the person we are and the person we want or ought to be. And then if you have these things like, I guess, false precision, which is this idea of a claim because it's using a number or some kind of metric or some kind of measurement, or even there's another term called seductive allure, which is scientific language making that claim feel more legitimate. One of the things is that we kind of bridge that gap between our, you know, the self-discrepancy gap, we bridge that by buying products. And I think vitamins and minerals and all of these added nutrients, that gives us that impression that we are bridging that gap.
So you said before that we're more likely to fall for these claims if we're sort of maybe stressed or anxious. Is there something about the way we perhaps lay out a shop that feeds that mental state?
Well, yes, and that could be the case. I think the thing is that we're always trying to basically fit in as well. And so when we go shopping, you know, we're kind of thinking, in a way, we can't process huge amounts of information. Most of us don't really know what a protein is. Most of us don't really know how nutrients work in the body. So if you're in the supermarket and it's just got a claim there, or if you're out and about with somebody, or if you're in a group and the group is saying, you know, we're all kind of getting ready for summer and we want to kind of fit the summer trend or something like that, what ends up happening is that we use a whole bunch of cues. The thing is, though, that then what we do is that we use those cues to help us to, I guess, ameliorate this fear of, am I making the wrong or the right decision? Because again, if something sounds sciencey, if something sounds like it's an important thing for us to be taking, we are drawn to it. And that's why, I mean, I don't know if you've ever tried them, Tegan, but protein balls are disgusting, but people buy them. And I think this is the thing. It's kind of like, I want a treat. If I have this treat, at least it's going to be good for me. And I think this is the thing, is that in reality, we need all of those nutrients, but not in the kind of numbers that we're kind of being told we need to consume them. And I think sitting underneath all of this thing is this, I guess, this discourse around this human need to control our bodies, to feel like we can steer how we feel and how we look. And I guess the food and the health cues just kind of help us to take control of those things because, you know, genetics and biology are really hard to understand.
You are listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm with Dr. Paul Harrison. He's the head of consumer behaviour at Deakin University. Every fortnight we have a chat. I call it Buyer Beware. And today we're talking about just foods that are fortified with all sorts of things. It's not really a chat about the health claims of those things and whether they check out from a health perspective or not, but more the way that we're marketed stuff by brands and maybe what the mental traps are that they're trying to make us fall into, but we're giving you the cheat code so that you can avoid them. Margaret says, I was picking up litter and I found a tube of eyelash glue, brush on adhesive with vitamins. I've never thought about wanting vitamins from eyelash glue, Paul. Have you ever bought eyelash glue?
No. But I definitely need more vitamins in my eyelashes. You should see them.
Another text says, I'm old enough not to be able to read the small print on back labels too well. I always forget to take my specs to the supermarket, so I'm always blissfully unaware of any additives. I suspect my life will be prolonged more by this blissful ignorance than any benefit attributable to the additives. Well, Paul, you mentioned before about this kind of primal want to control our bodies. I wonder if this time of year coming into the summer months, that is sort of dialed up even more?
I think it does. And I think what ends up happening around summer is that you become more aware of your body, how you look. And so the brain is automatically paying attention to anything connected to it. So it's just really an attentional shift. And then we have this kind of selective perception. So we kind of select information that helps us to make it relevant to us. And so if we're still kind of thinking about this self-discrepancy, this gap, you go, well, you know, this is who I am. And then you start doing social comparison and you kind of say, well, you know, people are beautiful in terms of the marketing and the advertising that goes on. And a health related message on a packet or a label. And I think that texter is actually, it's interesting because we're doing this study on labeling and they put these claims much bigger on the front now. So you don't need to read the detail. If you have a claim that says high in protein or even things like these cues like lighter, clean, you know, added something, it catches your attention in a way, I guess it wouldn't necessarily in winter because it's not as prominent in your kind of processing. And so it becomes relevant. The brain pulls it to the front. It's processed more quickly. And then ultimately you are kind of shifting. You are going, yeah, I should be drawn to this kind of food because summer is coming up. I need to think about the person that I should be or maybe even the person that I'm told I ought to be. And I think, again, this is where guilt comes in. You know, that if you people talk about, what is it, the beach body and things like that. I think these are all terminologies that we come to kind of just accept. And that then is fed into by the marketers.
So we're calling this chat Buyer Beware. What should we as buyers beware of here?
It's a tricky one, but I think one of the things is that, you know, ultimately if you don't fully understand how something works, most of the time you're probably doing okay. And, you know, life can be really hard if you're testing the claims of everything. Sometimes we just have to trust things. I would say, if you're buying food, eat food that makes you feel good. And you know, in my, I work with a lot of public health researchers and they kind of say, you know, eat food, mostly greens, in moderation. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the way to approach it, but also treats are good. Treats are part of what it is to be human. And I think we have to kind of also be conscious of the fact that we are living these lives and we need to kind of look after ourselves both mentally and physically.
He's got doctor in front of his name. He just said treats are good. Go forth and snack. Dr. Paul Harrison, thank you as always for joining me.
Cheers, Tegan.
Paul is head of consumer behaviour at Deakin University. Another text says, the other appeal of health products is the idea that they're antidotes that will cancel the effects of doing something unhealthy. Well, if you like health advice in podcast form, you'll love What's That Rash, the show that I do with Dr. Norman Swan, where we answer the health questions that everyone's asking. Yes, we've done ones on protein and all sorts of other supplements as well. You can find What's That Rash on the ABC Listen app. Also where you can subscribe to Life Matters if you're not already subscribed. earlier in the show on Life Matters, I spoke with Ogie Simic, who came to Australia as a refugee with his family when he was 11. He's now the head of refugee leadership and advocacy at the Asylum Seeker Resource Centre because Australia is on the cusp of welcoming its 1 millionth refugee since World War II. And I spoke to Ogie about what he remembers about when he first arrived in Australia.
Firstly, it's such a privilege to be able to reflect on what it means to be one in a million refugees welcomed since World War II. Unfortunately, my childhood was shattered by civil war that erupted in the hometown of Sarajevo, which was a place that only a few years before that was on global center stage as it held the Winter Olympics. Our journey was quite difficult, but eventually did lead us to Australia. It was the 8th of August, 1998. Just like your birth date, it's a date you never forget. I was 11 years old, and I remember stepping off the plane. We didn't speak any English. We didn't know anything about Australia. We didn't know anyone. As a kid, I still thought that I'd see kangaroos every day on my way to school. We're exhausted, frightened, but we were also relieved, maybe excited. My mum valued education above anything else, so we all went to school. My brother's to high school, I went to primary school. My mother went to English classes, then went on to do a bridging course at university to study, be a social worker. So many people had helped us that she wanted to give back. At night, we would sit at home and read the dictionary together, testing each other on what different words meant. We worked so hard to start a new life.
That's Ogie Simic, who's the head of refugee leadership and advocacy at the Asylum Seeker Resource Centre, talking to me earlier on Life Matters. And you were telling me your stories of how you came to be in Australia, whether it was your own migration story or that of your parents. I got so many texts that I had to stop reading them because I was going to start crying on the radio. Just the lengths that parents go to give their kids a better life. One here, my father immigrated to Australia from Lebanon in 1951 when he was 20. He always referred to Lebanon as his home, but he never took Australia for granted. Worked hard, married my mother, an Australian, supported all of his four children to attend university, and on a daily basis, he would say, "This is a great country," right up until he died at 96. Sian says we have First Nations, convict, and World War II heritage in our family. I recall my French grandmother recall how she could not find any vegetables or decent cheese here until the Italians and other Mediterranean people came. Thank goodness for a diversity of cultures and their food. Another says, my father was a refugee from Poland via Dachau, and my daughter-in-law's family were refugees from the killing fields in Cambodia. A shared respite in Australia. Well, that is almost all we've got time for today on Life Matters. I'm coming to you from Jagera and Turrbal land. Also earlier in the show, we talked about longer mortgages, whether that's an option for us in Australia. They're talking about bringing in 50-year mortgages in the US. Is that a way of making getting a mortgage more affordable? Does that mean that you'll be paying more over the life of a loan and maybe make it even longer until you own your home outright? Yes. Anyway, you were sending me your texts about your experiences. And one person says, I was divorced with three little kids about 40 years ago and was so incredibly fortunate to get a low interest loan from the ACT government. I now own my home and was able to retire at 65. Another says, I often think the auction market overinflates the cost of housing in Australia. It makes it competitive and difficult to attain for the regular person. What if the government abolished the auction system altogether and forced our housing market to have clear and transparent prices? Could that help with the ridiculous cost of housing we have at the moment? Another person says, when it comes to applying for a loan, I wish us renters could use our rent history as a deposit. Us renters are at a massive disadvantage trying to save the ungodly high deposit price. And honestly, you'd think proving you could pay a price on each price on time each time would be more valuable to a bank than someone who hoards wealth and doesn't spend anything. Thank you so much for your text. Talking about additives that claim to be good for you, Greta says nutrition advice is all about eating less fat, less salt, less sugar, less processed food, less overall. It seems very negative. So when someone advertises more messages with healthiness attached, it seems that much more attractive. Suddenly, it's not about denying yourself, it's about adding to yourself. Well, that is almost it for Life Matters. I've come to you today from Jagera and Turrbal land. Tomorrow on the show, we're going to talk about rites of passage, what schoolies looks like in 2025, and I also really want to know what you did when you finished school to celebrate, how that looks different to what young people today are doing. Plus, tomorrow is Leave Work on Time Day. We're going to look at whether our right to disconnect laws have made it easier to get out the door and leave work at work. Plus, what makes a strong mentor relationship? Don't forget, you can get in touch with me anytime. The email address is lifematters@abc.net.au, and I'll catch you tomorrow.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.